From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with investigative journalist Seymour Hersh about his breakthrough reporting on the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal. Hersh writes for The New Yorker. At the start of his career, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1969 reports revealing that American soldiers had massacred Vietnamese civilians in the village of My Lai. Hersh's new book, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib, expands on the reporting that he's done for The New Yorker in the past 3 years. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a batch of reissued Duke Ellington recordings from 1950 to 1961 on the Columbia label. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. People along the Gulf Coast are moving to higher ground as Hurricane Ivan churns northward with winds of 140 miles per hour. Zach Seidenberg reports from Tallahassee.
As Hurricane Ivan heads for the U.S. mainland, officials in the coastal counties along the Gulf of Mexico are preparing their communities for the worst. Michael Hardin, chief of emergency operations in Escambia County, Florida, which includes Pensacola, says thousands have been evacuated and shelters are now open as residents wait for Ivan.
Looking at a little over 130,000 folks that are in that impacted area that we're asking them to move to higher ground. So we've got all of the actions in motion to prepare for the arrival of Hurricane Ivan.
As Ivan continues to move into the Gulf, the extreme western panhandle of Florida still remains in the storm's predicted path. For NPR News, I'm Zach Seidenberg in Tallahassee.
A suicide car bomber killed at least 47 people and wounded more than 100 today in Baghdad. The bomber struck in a crowded street where recruits were waiting to sign up for the Iraqi police force. Power was out across Iraq for much of the day after saboteurs blew up a pipeline junction near the northern town of Beji, starting a fire that melted power lines. NPR's Peter Kenyon says much of the power has now been restored.
Officials say they have been working since 3 o'clock this morning, local time, to put the system back up. By late morning, they said it was about 30% restored. But clearly this shows how vulnerable the energy sector is, not just oil and oil supplies, which supplies 97% of the revenue, but also the electric supply, which is so vital here in the heat.
NPR's Peter Kenyon. President Bush spoke today before the National Guard Association in Las Vegas, promising to make mobilizations easier for Guard members and praising their service.
More than 185,000 Guard members have been called to serve on every front in the war on terror. You are a vital part of our strategy to defend America. You're fighting terrorist enemies in Iraq and Afghanistan and across the globe, so we do not have to face them here at home.
Meanwhile, Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry campaigned in Toledo, Ohio, accusing the Bush administration of dishonesty.
They hide the truth about Iraq. They hide the truth about No Child Left Behind. They hide the truth about what's happening in Medicare. And it's time we had a president who tells the American people the truth. It's that simple.
Democratic challenger John Kerry. Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 3 points to close at 10,318 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq was up 5 to 1915. This is NPR News. Primary elections are being held in 8 states and the District of Columbia today. It's the last big day of primary races before the November elections. In Washington state, voters are selecting party nominees for several open seats. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Seattle.
For the first time in 70 years, Washington state voters have to declare a party preference if they want to vote in partisan races, and then they can vote only for candidates of that party. The change is a result of court rulings that found the state's old blanket primary unconstitutional. In the race for governor on the Democratic ticket, Attorney General Christine Gregoire faces King County Executive Ron Sims. The winner of that race will likely face Republican Dino Rossi, a former state senator. In the 8th Congressional District, an open seat in a suburban Seattle swing district, there are intense battles in both the Republican and Democratic primaries. Among the candidates, a popular radio talk show host and the sheriff who caught the Green River Killer. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
President Bush's choice for CIA director, Porter Goss, faced tough questions today during his confirmation hearings in the Senate. Goss is a Republican congressman from Florida who formerly worked for the CIA. Senate Democrats questioned whether Goss could lay aside partisanship and provide the president with independent, objective information. Goss said he understands the need for the head of the CIA to be free from party biases. He also said it may take more than 5 years to hire and train the agents needed to bring the agency up to full effectiveness. Former CIA Director George Tenet had estimated that it would take about 5 years to bring his agency up to full strength. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, committed to providing an environment that supports its associates in their professional and personal lives. Our people make the difference. Information at walmartstores.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. His reports in The New Yorker magazine revealed many of the grim details about the beatings, sexual humiliations, and other tortures being committed by Americans in the Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad. His reports included photos showing GIs taunting naked Iraqi prisoners who were forced to assume humiliating poses. Several of these photos had been shown on CBS's 60 Minutes a few days before Hersh's first account was published, but Hersh had also obtained the report by Major General Antonio Tacuba, which found that between October and December of 2003, there were numerous instances of, quote, sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses at Abu Ghraib. Now Seymour Hersh has a new book called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. In 2004, he won a National Magazine Award for Public Interest for his New Yorker pieces on intelligence and the Iraq War. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1969 reports that American soldiers had massacred Vietnamese civilians in My Lai during a search-and-destroy mission. In Chain of Command, he says that the roots of the Abu Ghraib scandal lie not in the criminal inclinations of a few Army reservists, but in the reliance of George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld on secret operations and the use of coercion in fighting terrorism. We called the Defense Department for a response. They declined to speak, but referred us to a statement on their website, which says, "There are ongoing investigations, and there will be more information disclosed. Thus far, these investigations have determined that no responsible official of the Defense Department approved any program that could conceivably have authorized or condoned the abuses seen at Abu Ghraib." We'll read more of the statement at the end of the interview. I asked Seymour Hersh what his investigation reveals about whether people at the top of the chain of command knew what was going on in Abu Ghraib.
If you're talking about in September, October, November of 2003, did people in Washington and the White House know that these kids were totally out of control in the prison, the night shift, and taking the photographs? No, there's no evidence of that whatsoever, that anybody in Washington knew this kind of madness was going on. Of course, there's a big but the answer to your question is no.
And when is the moment that you think they did find out?
They were, technically the answer to that question is really simple. Somebody reported it in January of 2004. One of the military policemen in the unit was appalled, as I think were many others, but this person did something about it, a young man named Darby, and he told the local authorities that in the Army they call it the Criminal Investigation Division, the cops, the Army cops, and they began an investigation. I think this line of questioning, though, doesn't get to the real issue, because the real issue is an attitudinal one.
You say in your book that the roots of Abu Ghraib are in Bush and Rumsfeld's reliance on secret operations and the use of coercion in fighting terrorism. There's specifically a secret operations program that you think created the climate, is that fair to say, for the abuses at Abu Ghraib?
It was a symptom of the climate. What they did was in December, roughly 3 months after 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld is a very impatient man. Also, as we now know, the Pentagon was trying to take an awful lot of control, not only operationally for the war, but also in terms of intelligence. There was a lot of internecine competition between Rumsfeld and the other agencies, specifically the CIA. So about 3 months after the wars, after 9/11, Rumsfeld had just had it with this notion of going through the legal process to go after people we believe that were very important inside Al-Qaeda or international terrorists. To go arrest somebody, you have to go through an extradition process. It's sometimes it's called rendition. You have to go through a process in which the American ambassador in a country gets involved, local officials get involved, judicial people get involved, the FBI gets involved. Rumsfeld said, in a sense, the hell with it. Let's just set up a unit that's going to find bad guys, guys we think know information that is important to us. And again, in all fairness to everybody, in the weeks and months after 9/11, there was a tremendous sense not only of anger but also fear. We thought for sure whoever these people were, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, would strike again or could. And so Rumsfeld set up a secret unit. Everybody in it was undercover, and they had their own aircraft. They had their own helicopters, and they would hear about somebody we thought was important in the war on terrorism, somebody to interrogate, and they would just get into the country, get to the guy's house, and get him out, and not go through any formal process. And they were taken, these people often were taken for interrogation, I think in the beginning to Thailand, later certainly to Egypt, which has always been Egypt, the Egyptian government has been a huge player for the United States in the interrogation of prisoners, with the Egyptians doing it themselves and eventually Americans doing it. Those that were useful were kept around, I think in some cases, I use the word disappeared, gone. That doesn't necessarily mean they're dead. They're just out of circulation. Their families still don't know what happened to them. Some of the prisoners who turned out to not be useful were shipped down to Guantanamo in Cuba, the prison set up early in 2002. And eventually, and this is one of the amazing sort of facts, the sadness of Abu Ghraib is eventually in the fall of 2003, when the war clearly in Iraq was going badly, the insurgency was there, as many had predicted, and wasn't going away. And we had the UN blown up. We had the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad blown up. We had more oil wells put on fire, pipelines hit, water lines hit, all in August. And at that point, a decision was made, so I write, to bring some elements of this secret unit into Iraq to start educating and getting the interrogation process more fine-tuned. We weren't getting intelligence about the insurgency. That was the problem. We didn't know what was going to happen next.
Is there anything that was in this directive for the secret operations program that justified the use or opened the door to the use of that kind of interrogation technique, the kind of sexual humiliation that we saw, using of dogs, hooding, the hoods that were used?
Well, I don't know what instructions were given, specific instructions were given to the secret unit, but the reason you have a secret unit is because the rules don't apply. You know, the cliche that we see in so many of the White House documents and statements are the gloves are off. And I think there's no question this unit was given carte blanche to do whatever was necessary. And my friends also tell me, by the way, that the people who obviously inside the intelligence community inside this unit that know what's going on, that said to me in the beginning, the intent was really to get people who had information and get it out of them. And in some cases, as many in the audience know, torture doesn't really work for getting good intelligence. The best way you get intelligence is you establish some sort of rapport with the people. And I can't tell you whether the goal of the special unit was to get rough immediately or not. I can tell you that according to people in the unit, things deteriorated over the years. We're talking about a unit that's now been in operation almost 3 years. And I quote somebody in my book saying rather sadly, somebody in the unit, what do you call it when you torture somebody and you hurt him and he needs medical treatment and he doesn't get it and he dies a few days later? And the answer, he said, is execution. And at some point, he said, in a worrying way, there'll be a real investigation in the Congress, and we all of us in the unit who have been doing these things might get in trouble because who's going to defend us? So I don't, it's when you're dealing with secret units as a journalist, it's so complicated. I know the unit existed. I know there was a presidential finding for it. I've talked to those very senior people in the Congress who authorized such things. And, of course, the secrecy is so overwhelming. When you have a unit like this, it's called a special access program. So this unit began to fray in terms of what it was doing. It began to get more violent towards the prisoners, particularly as the insurgency continued. It was broad. There was an intellectual underpinning, and let me tell you what it was. It is a fact that you, by humility, one way to break an Arab, a sophisticated Arab, is a sexual humiliation. In the Arab world, the idea of being photographed, a male being photographed in the nude, obviously for a female too, it's the ultimate form of degradation. And also the notion that you would photograph him simulating homosexual acts, as we the photographs we've seen in Abu Ghraib, and the notion that a woman would be there with the thumbs up or thumb down, an American woman would be there observing this and making fun of it. And the idea was, and I was told this in the beginning, you use this selectively for people you want to recruit. And let me explain that. We had no intelligence about the insurgency in Iraq. We had arrested, by this time, by the fall of 2003, when this program began, September, when Abu Ghraib, the abuses began, there were maybe, I think, as many as certainly more than 10, 15, 20,000 Iraqis had been arrested, many of them in routine sweeps of traffic blocks. And the goal was to take young men, put them in a position where they were sexually humiliated, take photographs of them, and then you would have potential blackmail material. And then you could perhaps tell these young men, go home to your community, join the insurgency, and start telling us what's going on. The idea was to recruit people. And of course, whatever the intent was in September, it quickly transmogrified into something that we now know, that horrible abuses. And what's interesting is, let me just say this, in October of 2003, the CIA, which has been not adverse to very rough interrogations, the CIA officials in the prison were so appalled by what they were seeing, they withdrew their people from the prison. And this I know from not one, not two, three or four people in the agency. They actually told their people to get out of there because all hell was going to break loose.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Seymour Hersh. He broke the Abu Ghraib story in the New Yorker magazine. He's collected and added to what he's reported on since September 11th in his new book called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. Now, you're surprised that after Rumsfeld did find out about Abu Ghraib, and he says he found out in January of 2004?
Four, yes.
That, you know, that the Pentagon issued a kind of, as you put it, blandly worded short press release saying that there's going to be an investigation into abuse at the prison. But you're surprised that he didn't do more or say more, that he wasn't more shocked, that he wasn't more curious.
Well, common sense would tell you in retrospect that you have photographs. Look, what made the story of Abu Ghraib a story? I could have written 500,000 words about it, and so could other reporters. What made it were the photographs. Once you saw those photographs, and once you know those photographs were in circulation, one of the problems they had in the investigation, they discovered that all of the military policemen and many of the people who were serving in the military units and on detail at Abu Ghraib, not only military police, but military intelligence officers and regular army soldiers. You know how kids are today, CD-ROM, they copy music all the time. Well, they copied all these photographs in the CDs, and they were all over the place. And one of the first goals in the early days of the investigation was to go around and collect these CDs from the various soldiers. Soldiers who had nothing to do with it had these photographs. So the photographs were lethal, just lethal. And, you know, and Rumsfeld saw him. It certainly was briefed on him. I can't say that he actually saw him until later. The chief of staff or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Myers, said he was aware of it. You know, I think Rumsfeld testified there were many thousands of court-martials every year in the military. Somehow this case, as the Pentagon has acknowledged, somehow within 2 days of learning about what happened in Abu Ghraib, Rumsfeld tells the president about it. This is according to the Pentagon's own chronology in early January. Clearly, they knew there was something special about this. And so the obvious question is, why not make it public yourself and take the beating, make it something you put out? Because if you have the other guys, you know, you're going to have military court-martials. You can't stop that. And these photographs are going to get into lawyers' hands, are going to get into the press. But they didn't choose. They chose not to do so. And you have to only wonder, are they that obtuse? My speculation, if it means anything, is they were protecting the secret operation as much as anything else, too.
You also said that there was a policy of no resignations, that Vice President Cheney phoned Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld with the message, no resignations. How did you find out about that, and how do you interpret it?
What happened was, after the Abu Ghraib stories broke, largely because a lot of the stuff I wrote in The New Yorker in May, the vice president did call Rumsfeld and said, no resignations, we're going to tough it out, hang tough, everybody stay together. I can tell you that's very pro forma for these guys. The idea is, in this White House, you hang tough, you give up nothing. That's standard. It's everything is political. I think the point of the call, as I wrote in the book, was it wasn't that, was nothing more than he was saying, this is a political problem now, we have to deal with it politically, sensitively, and no squeamishness. And I can tell you I learned about it from one of the highest ranking defense officials that we have in our government. And that's as much as I can say, because I look clearly at Terry in the last 3 years. I've been doing a lot of stories that are very critical.
Right.
And clearly there's an alternative. People are talking to me on the inside. You know, I wouldn't say they're a funnel. I don't want to diminish what I'm doing. I don't want to pat myself on the back too much either, because clearly people on the inside have been talking to me, because there is an alternative history of this war that they want out.
My guest is Seymour Hersh. His new book is called Chain of Command. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Seymour Hersh. His new book, Chain of Command, expands on his reporting in The New Yorker magazine since September 11th. He broke much of the Abu Ghraib story. Do you think your reports on Abu Ghraib would have been anything like what they were if you didn't have the photographs? Would people have believed you, do you think, if you didn't have the photographs as evidence?
I think the story would not have had the impact it did, but there was also something else. I also did get my hands on the first report by a general named Taguba, the now pretty well-known Taguba report, which was an amazingly honest report for a military report, much better than the reports that we've seen in the last, you know, 4 or 5 months, particularly the most recent ones. This was a report that was devastating and condemnation of what happened, and also made the point it was institutionalized, that it went through the chain of command. Taguba wasn't saying that everybody knew about it, but he was saying that these kinds of violations could not be localized. They had to be authorized at a much higher level. And it was the kind of report that I said in print once, and that I doubt if he's a major general, is going to see many more promotions, because he really did sort of unravel a lot of things that the Army preferred not to be unraveled. And amazingly courageous. It's to the credit of the Army and to the credit of General Taguba that a report like this existed. But basically, the simple answer to your question is, the pictures, the old cliche, worth a thousand words, the pictures did it. They drove the story all the way. We've seen a lot more photographs. We haven't published more stuff. Look, of course, the young men and women who did what they did in Abu Ghraib, the reservists, mostly from a unit in West Virginia, they're certainly guilty of what they did. But I can tell you that they're also aware there's the shame. And I can tell you, when we send children into the Army, the officers who take control of these people, the captains and the majors and the colonels and the generals and the Secretary of Defenses and the President, they become in loco parentis. They become the parents, the not virtual, but in practice, the parents. And the goal of a good parent is not to get their children hurt, of course. They want to protect them as much as possible, but also to protect them from themselves. And the failure here is so enormous that so many officers, we now know from the other investigations, knew so much about what was going on, and nobody could protect these young people from their own worst instincts. this is a scandal about which we're not really coming to terms.
Now, you say that you've seen more photos. Members of Congress have seen more photos, and they have basically said that the photos that they've seen that the public hasn't are horrifying. There's sexual photos in there. It sounds like there are rapes and or something along those lines. You're choosing for now not to publish the photos that you have, the ones that we have not yet seen. Why are you choosing at this point to not publish them?
Oh, well, I can't speak. My book isn't publishing any photographs.
No, but in The New Yorker, you did publish a lot of photographs, well, but you're not going with these.
David, the decision that was made by the editors and with which I agreed, and I don't always agree with editors, is that there's a sense of how much do you shame the Arab man? You know, if you go into, you know, we Americans come from a society.
So it's out of respect to the people being humiliated, not out of respect to the American soldiers who are involved with the techniques?
No, I think really it's the first. It was nothing to do with the American soldiers. There was no sense here. The sense was how much is enough? We get the drift of what happened. And, you know, these men, many of them were found later and interviewed by reporters and described. I remember one vivid story in the New York Times of one of the people in one of the horrible pictures. There were, you know, there were the pictures that the New Yorker published of a dog. I mean, this man was bitten by the dog. And so where do you draw the line? And we have photographed evidence of that. So you draw a line that makes sense, it made sense to me, which is you get the drift. You know, we understand how bad it is. Most of the pictures were even distorted a little bit. It's plenty bad enough. And, you know, the Arab world, the enormity, to use that word right, of what happened, in the Arab world, they see us as, I'm talking about the moderate Arabs, the ones who are pro-Americans, who want to send their children here. They see this as evidence that America's become sexually perverted. I mean, they are just staggered by these photographs. Why would anybody do this? I had an Israeli friend, a very tough Israeli friend of mine, a retired commando and intelligence officer, who said to me, he said, you know, I hate Arabs, and they hate us. I've been killing Arabs for 50 years, and they've been killing us for 50 years. But we know, we in the Israeli military and intelligence service, we know that one day we may have to live with those SOBs. And let me tell you something, Hershey said. If we treated our Arabs in the jail the same way you treated yours, we couldn't live with them.
Seymour Hersh will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Chain of Command. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by HBO Video, presenting Angels in America, newly released on DVD, starring Al Pacino, Meryl Streep, and Emma Thompson, and based on Tony Kushner's play. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Fortress America, On the Front Lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state by Matthew Brzezinski. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh looks back on breaking the story that American soldiers massacred Vietnamese civilians in My Lai, and he considers how that story continues to affect America. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a batch of Duke Ellington reissues recorded between 1950 and 61 on the Columbia label. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. His new book, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib, expands on his reporting for The New Yorker magazine over the past 3 years, including his reports which broke much of the Abu Ghraib story. When we left off, we were talking about how important the photos were in documenting what happened at the prison. Now, the producers at 60 Minutes had obtained some of the photos of the torture at Abu Ghraib prison, though they didn't have the report by General Taguba, which you did have. 60 Minutes held off broadcasting those photos and the story at the request of the Pentagon. They eventually played it, but initially they held off at the Pentagon's request. Did the Pentagon know that you were going to publish the Abu Ghraib photos in The New Yorker and go with the story? And if so, what was their response? Did anyone from the Pentagon try to stop you from publishing?
Well, no. Without being overly self-service, you know, I don't want to pat myself on the back, but there would be no reason anybody in the Pentagon would think I would not publish. And in fact, it's because CBS did not publish that I got into the story.
What was the connection?
Well, somebody, there was a lot of unhappiness among certain people in the military and others who had had helped CBS that they weren't publishing the story. I think they held it a few weeks, and somebody eventually came to me, and that's how I learned about it. And then I was, you know, I was able to not only obtain the photographs, but also obtain the report, and so. You know, CBS, when they did publish, by the way, did a first-rate job. But, you know, one has to, in retrospect, I wish I could say I thought CBS was the only network that wouldn't publish like that, you know, would have been held off. But, you know, this is a very tough time for major networks with a very tough government. It was an election year coming. It's a little stunning that that a story that's been widely described as the most significant, of army malfeasance, certainly, perhaps since My Lai, took so long. A network took so long to get the pictures on air.
In your mind, what was the argument for going with the story, and what would have been the argument for sitting on it or not going with it at all?
The argument for going.
And I'm not asking you to talk on behalf of CBS, but just as yourself as a reporter, knowing the huge implications that publishing this would have.
Oh, my God. It's not even an argument. You know, our job is to report what's there. The idea that Arabs who were not found guilty of anything, who has legal status had not been adjudicated, one of the problems we have in the whole, since the beginning of the war, has been a complete inability to differentiate between bad guy and good guy. And one of the things that was so overwhelmingly depressing in the early days about Guantanamo, there was no system for differentiation in violation of the Geneva Convention, et cetera, and also common sense and human dignity. Terry, it's a question that I don't even understand how, you know, at least from my point of view, I mean, like, duh, you know.
You have a pretty extraordinary record when it comes to breaking stories. And, you know, during the war in Iraq, you've broken several really important stories, including, of course, Abu Ghraib. Back in the war in Vietnam, you broke the story of the My Lai massacre. You broke the story of the secret bombing of Cambodia. Since Vietnam is so much back in the news now because of the presidential campaign, I'm interested if you could compare the reaction you got to breaking the Abu Ghraib story and breaking the story about the My Lai massacre.
Yeah, that's a good question. My Lai was a much different. Look, I grew up in the South Side of Chicago. I was born in 1937, and at the end of World War II, I used to go as a kid. My older sisters would take us to the Victory Theater, and I used to watch Saturday afternoon movies. And it was always, we were fighting the Nips, and it was always the Americans were John Wayne and Van Johnson and Robert Mitchum. Were fellow fighters against the Nips, and they would be one night they'd all be carousing and fighting over a nurse, and the next day they're up in the air and they're up against the Nips, and there would be a scene and the nips always flew with the canopies closed and squinting, and these little leather hats that were tied under, you know, little bows under their chin. Our guys had the canopy open, no hats, scarves, going thumbs up all the time. And at a critical moment, one nip would be ready to kill Van Johnson, and Robert Mitchin, who'd been fighting Van Johnson the night before, or about a nurse, would go and fire some bullets. And then we'd watch in the movie. The plane would be going along, and all of a sudden a bunch of bullets came in there. And the plane, we'd hear the noise, it started going down, the careening, go down. And just before it hit the water, a trickle of blood would come out of the nip's mouth, right? And he'd hit the water, and we'd all cheer. So Milai, what did Milai say to the American people? Wow, guess what? We don't fight war any better than the Nips and the Krauts of World War II. We fight it just as badly. War is hell. And the public really didn't know that. They really didn't understand. They'd seen these movies. We now know from the works of Paul Fussell and others, that wonderful historian, that a lot of the photographs from the combat of World War II in Korea were censored. We weren't allowed in America because of censorship to see dead bodies, etc. And so we really didn't have an understanding of what war was about. And so Milai was horrific. Now we're wiser. We've gone through Vietnam. We know there's nothing, no virtue in war. We know that bombs don't go where they're aimed. And so this story, instead of triggering animosity, I think really had an impact in a way that it cut across ideological boundaries. Because even guys that support the war cannot support what we did in Abu Ghraib. And the investigations so far are complete. There's some very good stuff in terms of what happened in the prison system. Some of the army investigations are great. There are a complete washout when it gets into the higher chain of command. And it's not, Terry, that Donald Rumsfeld or Vice President Cheney knew and authorized. That's the way they always put it in their releases when they've been criticizing my book, saying nothing. Nobody ever authorized. There's no evidence that anybody was linked to Abu Ghraib. That's not the point. The point is that the guys at the top, Condoleezza Rice, we know, Rumsfeld, all sorts of senior officers understood there were serious problems with the prison system, at least by the fall of 2002, and nobody did anything. And what message does that send?
My guest is Seymour Hersh. His new book is called Chain of Command. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Seymour Hersh is my guest, and his reports in The New Yorker broke the story of Abu Ghraib, and now he has a new book called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. Do you think that the Bush administration, that people high up in the Bush administration have any second thoughts about Iraq? I mean, let's face it, they didn't predict the nature of this insurgency. Do you think that they are having second thoughts?
Mm. Are you kidding? The president? No, absolutely not. Not a second thought at all. And they may not have predicted the insurgency, but all kinds of rational people who worked for them did. I mean, it was certainly well known. I think one of the great shibboleths of this whole last few months has been the notion that somehow the Senate Intelligence Committee report suggesting that the CIA misled the president about weapons of mass destruction, WMD. The fact of the matter is the CIA was pressured. There were many people in the CIA who had enormous disagreement with the idea that Iraq, Saddam was lethally or a serious threat from weapons of mass destruction. And the White House overran him. That's all there is.
You point out the three Democrats on that Senate Intelligence Committee wrote a dissenting report saying that the intelligence agencies were pressured by the White House to give the intelligence that they gave, and therefore the White House is culpable, too.
But they signed the report. What I noticed is in the epilogue, what struck me as staggering, this is including Senator Levin of Michigan, who's certainly one of the brightest guys in the Senate. They signed the report, though. I mean, it says something. To me, that sort of says something about the time, sort of the fear we have. Here are a group of senators who sign a report that they immediately disavow. But they signed it. And everybody, I think there's so much pressure not to appear to be disloyal. Maybe it's the residue of 9/11. But at some point, we're going to have to decide that 9/11 cannot shape our destiny forever, that terrorism is a horrible as it was, and everybody, none of us, you know, I don't have to say the obvious, but we're going to have to come to a better understanding of terrorism. And it doesn't mean not be worried about it, but means we have to cope better with it. We can't simply let the prospect of another attack make us ignore the reality of today, and that's what we're doing collectively.
One of the many stories you broke was that the CIA in the 1960s spied on people who were deemed to be domestic enemies. Were you ever spied on?
Oh, I don't want to know.
Why not?
I just don't want to know because let me tell you something. I think I have as much right. I'm as good of American as anybody in the White House, as anybody with 2, 3, and 4 stars on their shoulders. That's what makes America so great. My parents are both from immigrants, and I went to public school in Chicago. We had no money, and I didn't pay for education. I got out of college. I was an editor of the Yale Daily News or the Harvard Crimson, and 11 years after getting out of college in Chicago, I'm sticking 2 fingers with the My Lai stories into the eye of a sitting Republican president, Richard Nixon, and getting accolades for it, Pulitzer Prizes, war, fame, fortune, glory. And it's not many countries you can do that in, and that's still real. In other words, this is still a country which has enormous respect for people taking the initiative. I wish the press would do more.
What are some of the biggest differences for you in the process of investigative reporting in the 60s when you started doing this and now?
You know, it hasn't changed much. It's always in the medium. It hasn't changed much. I do the same thing. I was very lucky because all during the early 70s, I worked at the New York Times during Watergate, and I had an editor who was, you know, Abe Rosenthal, who was, you know, politically, I disagreed with every story I wrote, but never intervened. He always judged the stories on their merits, and it took a lot of integrity. And at The New Yorker, David Remnick hasn't agreed with everything I've written, but he has the same willingness to look at a story and, you know, everything doesn't come from him. I mean, he can see. And there is, I will tell you this, there is something remarkable about The New Yorker because everything is, they have this fact-checking, and you can talk about it all you want. It's very real. This book, for example, was edited by a New Yorker editor and fact-checked by a New Yorker, one of the better New Yorker, they're all good, one of the very good ones at The New Yorker, fact-checked. And the publisher, my publisher, actually HarperCollins, actually invested money to make sure it was done to the same standards as everything in The New Yorker. So when I write a story about a secret unit, and I'm talking to people very much in the inside, the people I talk to, and many of them I've known for many years, do talk to the fact checkers. Not just a question of my editors knowing who they are and their credentials. They talk to the fact checker. You mentioned the story about Cheney and the call he made to Rumsfeld. That was given to me by
the call that there'd be no resignations.
Right. Well, that was made by a very prominent official who did, at my request, talk to a fact checker and repeat the story. It's funny because I know these guys. I know Rumsfeld. I know Scooter Libby. I know a lot of these guys. I've been around Washington forever, you know, since the 60s. And I always liked Donald Rumsfeld. I always liked the Donald Rumsfeld I knew until the last 3 years. Something about 9/11, all of a sudden, it wasn't, you know, my take on Rumsfeld, by the way, is you cannot separate Rumsfeld from the men running the government. The notion that he's somehow different. When George Bush says, I want to drive these guys out of their snake holes, Donald Rumsfeld's the guy who does it. He understands that as an order. That's how a special operation team gets developed, because of a presidential request. Rumsfeld is in the flow. They're all as one. He takes the heat. But when I knew him, funny, charming, witty, great imitation of Sandy Berger. And all of a sudden, the guy, I'm not kidding. I mean, I talked to him in those years, during the Clinton years. And now you're either with him or against him. The president made that at a very early speech after 9/11. And that really has become a mantra for these guys. And so we in the press that don't always fall in line are cut out. And other reporters, and here's one of the problems, the dilemmas you have, and the networks, if they go too far, they don't get access. And that's what these guys do. Everybody wants to do it. The Clintons tried to do it, but they were always too disorganized to get it done. These guys get it done. And so I can tell you right now, I'm a journalist. I'm also very much an American, as I said, as an American, you know, and this is a great country. And I don't want to run a story that will jeopardize an ongoing intelligence operation or will jeopardize people. And in every administration until this one, I've had high-level people I could go to privately. Now I've gerrymandered way. I let people, there's some people I give my stories to, you know, dropping off in a mailbox, you know, at night or something like that, so they can read it. Not for accuracy, but just to make sure there was nothing in there that would jeopardize an ongoing program or people in the field. And I've made changes, not that many, but I've made changes because I have a sort of a sense of what to do. But I've been forced to do it by, you know, going the night before publication, the night the magazine closed, and sticking stuff in a guy's mailbox and having him call me the next morning. It's a whole new level of dissidence that we have inside this government. You know, I thought his address at the convention, when he started talking about the success we're having in Afghanistan and Iraq and the elections coming and democracy is there, it was hallucinatory to me. It was like, wow. But he believes it. He's not lying. He really believes it. And you know what's dangerous about these guys? It's not, believe me, it's not that they're lying, conniving, and that this is all done for oil and it's all done for Israel. These are people who are utopians. They are really idealists, very dangerous, because they really did believe that democracy, when they were going to go into Iraq, and they went with 150,000 troops, they thought they could go in with 5,000, some special forces guys, a few bombs, and a lot of American flags, and lay them down. And not only would peace reign and a new government would take place, but democracy would flow like water from the tap, from the fountains. And not only that, it would spread to Syria and Iran. These guys really believed that this was going to happen. And if you remember the fighting about General Shinseki, remember General Shinseki said before the war that there would be 200,000 troops and everybody in the government was mad? They weren't mad at him because he mentioned a number. They were mad at Shinseki because, my God, he'd been in the tank. He'd heard what they said. Didn't he understand that once we went in, democracy would fly? You didn't need any troops. Didn't he get it? Hadn't he listened to what Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld was saying to the generals in the tank and the Joint Chiefs of Staff meeting? He didn't understand. That was the complaint, in my view. It wasn't that he mentioned 200,000 or 300,000 troops. Is he didn't get it. They all had a shared understanding that it was completely mad and wrong, meant nothing.
One last question. I'm wondering if readers can expect to be reading more investigative pieces by you in the near future in The New Yorker, if you're working on something now.
Well, you know, my nightmare is I'm going to have to do 4 more years of this. You know, my God. I'd like to get back to, organized crime or something pleasant. the answer is yes, I know. Not so much. The answer is yes, I'm working on other stuff. Of course I am. Not of this scope. But this is a government of complete disconnects. And so there's a lot of stories in the government, of course. You know, it's in a way it's manna. In another way, it's enough already.
Well, Seymour Hersh, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, bye-bye.
Seymour Hersh's new book is called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. The book says that the roots of the Abu Ghraib scandal lie not in the criminal inclinations of a few Army reservists, but in the reliance of President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld on secret operations and the use of coercion in fighting terrorism. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we called the Defense Department for their comments. They declined to speak, but referred us to a statement on their website, which says, quote, "Based on media inquiries, it appears that Mr. Seymour Hersh's upcoming book apparently contains many of the numerous unsubstantiated allegations and inaccuracies which he has made in the past based upon unnamed sources. Detainee operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere have been examined extensively. To date, the department has conducted 11 investigations, of which 8 reports have been completed and released. There are ongoing investigations, and there will be more information disclosed. Thus far, these investigations have determined that no responsible official at the Department of Defense approved any program that could conceivably have authorized or condoned the abuses seen at Abu Ghraib. If any of Mr. Hersh's anonymous sources wish to come forward and offer evidence to the contrary, the department welcomes them to do so. There are several open investigations, and we would certainly investigate their allegations without prejudice or hesitation, unquote. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a batch of Duke Ellington reissues. This is Fresh Air. Over the summer and spring, Columbia re-released six albums Duke Ellington recorded for the label between 1950 and 1961. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead provides a quick survey with plenty of music thrown in.
Duke Ellington and the Orchestra, 1959, on Blues in Blueprint, with Harry Carney playing that fractured boogie bass line on bass clarinet. It's on Blues in Orbit, just back out on Columbia. We could go on about the infinite varieties of Duke's blues and his peerless gift for exploiting distinctive soloists, but let's have more music instead. The 1951 album, Masterpieces by Ellington, has long and elaborate versions of his older classics. On a revamped Mood Indigo, the 1930 tune by Ellington and Barney Bigard is a pioneer's log cabin dwarfed by skyscrapers. The new Ellington reissues include a pair of early 60s albums more heard of than heard, Piano in the Foreground and Piano in the Background. The latter features more but shorter updated oldies, including a few charts by outside arrangers. Los Angeles bandleader Gerald Wilson's version of Perdido is a Hollywood spectacular, but the saxophone writing has the Ellington touch. That's Jimmy Hamilton on clarinet. Thank you. Ray Nance and Willie Cook on trumpets, from the CD Piano in the Background. Piano in the Foreground is stripped-down Duke with just bass and drums, playing a few standards and some lesser-known tunes of his own. It's tasty, less tumultuous than Money Jungle with Max Roach and Charles Mingus a year later. All these Ellington reissues have excellent notes by Patricia Willard and a smattering of bonus tracks. The five untitled pieces from 1957 added to Piano in the Foreground steal the show. You can hear how Duke uses piano to sketch out the sound of the orchestra. Jimmy Woody on bass. Duke Ellington, writing music was like breathing. As a composer doomed to play his old hits for the people, he had the wisdom to keep reinventing them, to take their place beside his new stuff and the endlessly renewable form of the blues.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Downbeat and The Absolute Sound. He reviewed Duke Ellington reissues on the Columbia label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by TIAA Craft, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org, and from Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback The Lord is My Shepherd by Harold Kushner, author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor for Newsweek magazine. His new novel, The Sleeper, is a thriller about a former terrorist who, after September 11th, goes to hunt down his former Al-Qaeda comrades. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.